This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com. It's June. Happy June. We believe there's no time quite like summer to enjoy some country music. BGS is leaning into all things quality country with our sister site, Good Country. This month's edition of Good Country highlights Artist of the Month, Jody Messina, and we have sit-downs with Braxton Keith, the Broody Brothers, and Ashley McBride. Dive in at thebluegrasssituation.com/goodcountry, and thank you for being part of the BGS and Good Country communities. Hello and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation. This is me, Cindy Howes, and I host this podcast. Thanks for finding us. Very happy to have Naomi Westwater on the podcast today. Before we get into that, let's talk about ways to stay in touch. My New Year's resolution was to send a Basic Folk newsletter. If you'd like to sign up for the newsletter, you can do so at the link in the show notes. Or you can go to basicfolk.com and sign up for the newsletter there. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. We're on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. We are a listener-supported podcast. You can make a financial contribution at basicfolk.com/donate. That's about it. Okay, right now I am coming to you from underneath a hotel bathrobe in a room at the Sheraton in New Orleans for Folk Alliance. It's day one, so I haven't gotten into any trouble yet. I'm going to try to keep a good bedtime and hopefully see some great music. Let's get to the show today. Naomi Westwater. Something you might notice about Boston-based musician Naomi Westwater is that they have both sides of the brain on lock. They are very good at community organizing, grant applying, advocating, and other left-brained activities. However, they are also a creative, deeply spiritual, open-hearted person, which is associated with the right brain, not always something that goes hand in hand, but it is a beautiful thing when it does. Westwater, who identifies herself as a queer and Black multiracial person, grew up on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, where they never really felt like they fit in. Thanks to their parents, there was a lot of music being played, reggae, jazz, funk, classic rock, and 70s feminist folk. There was always a deep connection with nature, which plays into their spiritual practice and their songwriting, two areas that she had previously kept separate. On their new album, Cycle and Change, Naomi made an effort to fully embrace her identity as a songwriter and a witch. She shares each song ties back to its seasonal context, weaving a story that spans spring's hopeful beginnings, summer's vibrancy, autumn's introspection, and winter's quietude. Right in the final stretch of preparing to release the album, all these very hard things happened. The sudden loss of Naomi's father. They also went through a divorce and relocated. It was as if they had created the blueprint for remaining grounded during these challenging life changes. We get into all of this as well as navigating self-advocacy while struggling to get their endometriosis and adenomyosis diagnosed and treated as what the impact of their father's death had on their creativity. Let's take a listen to a song from Cycle and Change. We'll hear a clip of the track Bulbs, and then we'll get to our conversation with Naomi Westwater on Basic Folk.
I garden in October. It's a promise to myself that I'm gonna make it through the winter. Yeah, I'm gonna make it. I plant bulbs in November and I cross my fingers. I hope I'm gonna make it through the winter. I hope I'm my seeds in December, and I pray to a God I don't know. Lord, I want to make it through this winter. Lord, I want to make it. Though it's dark outside, though I can't sick today of myself and my loneliness, you know I'm gonna make it. Well, I trust that by the summer I will see your face again, 'cause I'm
Naomi Westwater, it's so nice to meet you. Thanks for coming on Basic Folk.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
You grew up on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. What town did you grow up in?
I grew up in Falmouth and in Mashpee, which are right next to each other.
Okay. Yes. Very familiar. My cousin's family has a little cottage in Mashpee. So we did a, you know, Mashpee Commons, the flea market.
Mm-hmm.
Movie theater. There wasn't any air conditioning in that cottage, so we'd go to the movies a lot in the summertime.
Totally. Yeah. I went to the movies a lot. Yes.
Yeah. So I read that you never felt like you fit in on Cape Cod. And so for those who are not familiar, like we are, what was Cape Cod like for you growing up and why didn't you feel like you fit in?
Well, especially in the 90s when I was growing up there and early 2000s, Cape Cod is very white. I was, I think, the only Black person in my middle school and just one of like a handful of people of color. And it's different now, but there are aspects of the Cape, especially in the winter, that can feel quite rural, actually, and very isolated. And I love Cape Cod. I go back there all the time, and I feel like a relationship with the nature there as well as a lot of the people. But as a kid, I didn't feel like I fit in. And I was constantly kind of lovingly, but constantly kind of people were like questioning like my hair and my identity. And it just made me feel othered often.
Yeah. Where were the respites on Cape Cod for you?
Mashpee has such a beautiful beach, South Cape. And one of the things that's really beautiful about South Cape is there's like this path that has the bay on one side and the ocean on the other side. And I love going out there, walking out there, swimming there. And then it's part of a state park. So there's also woods there too. And when I was younger, I would just kind of go and wander in the woods around our house and in our neighborhood and get lost with the dog. And, you know, it's small enough that it was okay for me to just wander, but especially in the off season, you could be out there and not see another person for a really long time and just kind of feel like you have the woods to yourself.
Awesome. It seems like thanks to your parents, there was a lot of music being played in the house, reggae, jazz, funk, classic rock, 70s feminist folk, the also important 70s feminist folk.
Yeah.
How is the way that they felt about music? How has that impacted the way you have ended up feeling about music?
I think in general, my parents were not artists, but art was very important to them, and not in like a highbrow way. It just was like a part of everyday life. So there was always music. They were going to shows a lot, and my first concert, I was 3 years old, and we went, my mom and I went to Great Woods and saw Bonnie Raitt. Like, it just was kind of,
okay.
Yeah, incredible, right? So it just was like, music was just always part of the atmosphere. And
how many times did you go to the Cape Cod Melody Tent?
Yeah, many times.
The stage spins.
Yeah, many times. Because a lot of, actually a lot of reggae artists play there in the summertime. So we would go all the time. And yeah, it just was kind of, art was almost assumed in my house. Like, and my parents would, my dad would listen to opera while he was paying the bills. And then they would also, you know, listen to whatever popular music as well, and reggae and everything. So it was a really wide spectrum of music that was playing in our house.
Mm, cool. Was it art beyond music as well? I know you are a poet and have a lot of love for poetry.
Yeah, my godmother was a poet growing up. So, and she was in my life a lot. And so just getting a lot of like poetry from her, and we would go to museums and go to a lot of theater, especially when I was younger, we'd go to theater. So art just was kind of like, it just was a normal part of our everyday life. Like, I didn't think about it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When did playing your own music and writing your own songs come into your life? And like, what was the reason you started, and how do you relate to that reason now?
When I was 4, my parents got me a keyboard that had presets on it, and you would like press a button and some kind of like public domain, like synth song would start playing. And so before I could actually play an instrument, I would press that preset and I would write my own lyrics over those melodies. So I started writing as soon as I could talk, and I was writing poetry as soon as I could write. And
what were these poems like? Release the tapes.
My first poem was at 8 years old, and it was about nothingness.
Oh my God. Stop it.
Yeah. It was kind of like, I don't remember all of it, but I remember it was like kind of heavy. It was about nothing, being nothing, nothingness. So, but I think there was like no reason for me to start music writing or singing or any of it. I just felt like called to do it. And I think as I've grown up, music has been sort of a therapy for me. And so it became like a tool for processing whatever was going, especially in my, you know, tween and teen years.
You're a highly spiritual person and a highly creative person. What did those attributes look like for you growing up? Like, where was spirituality? Where was creativity? And when did you start feeling ownership of them?
That's a good question. Well, my parents were both very alternative. So they both grew up in the kind of Christian, different Christian faiths. And they both ended up kind of rejecting those faiths as adult, but they really encouraged me to, like, religion was something that was encouraged but never forced on me. So, you know, I would go to Shabbat when I slept over on Friday nights at my Jewish friend's house, we would do Shabbat. And if I slept over my Christian friend's house on Saturday, we would go to church on Sunday. And so I got like a really just like versatile religious education as a kid. When we moved from Falmouth to Mashpee when I was 12, and my mom was in a woman's group that was like a kind of neo-pagan feminist witch group for years. And my dad had joined a spiritualist church, which is a branch of Christianity that believes that Christ was a psychic medium. And they had like a house blessing. And it was like my mom's, like the 13 of my mom's women's group, like chanting, and my dad's minister in the yard with a didgeridoo. And I remember being so embarrassed at 12 years old, like, like the whole neighborhood will now know that we are not a normal family.
Here they come.
Yeah. But I think what all of that instilled in me is permission to be spiritual and permission to, there was never any pressure. It just was like, these are all these things that are available to you if you want them. And then when I got to college, I really wanted to have a spiritual practice in community with people. And I started my own circles, and we started meeting, I think this was all the way back in like 2010. And we would meet for like full moons and for the solstices and equinoxes. And I started kind of becoming more of a leader and guiding people through spiritual practices. And I'm still doing that. I started a coven in Boston in 2018, and we're still meeting 8 times a year now. So it's just become part of my life.
What does the spiritual practice look like for you now?
So many different things, both from like really mundane things to like deep, thoughtful, intentional ritual. My dad passed away in April. So a big thing for me now is like I have an ancestor altar, which I've had for many years, but I have the ancestor altar set up, and I like to like every day just like go there and light a candle or some incense. And there's a brand of lip balm that my dad really liked, and I have that like on the altar, and like I go there and put the lip balm on and like think about him and like,
wow, he must have really liked that lip balm. That's like very specific.
Yeah, it's like a very specific brand.
Yeah.
So that's just like a part of my everyday life that just takes, you know, like 1 minute, 2 minutes a day of just kind of thinking of those people. I have a full moon book club. We meet every full moon, and we do a ritual, which sometimes is tarot, sometimes it's meditation. Sometimes we like will write a letter to our future selves. I do spell work. I think to me, like writing a song, writing a poem, writing a spell, they're all interchangeable. Like oftentimes it's some kind of emotion that I'm wanting to bring out into the world, or something I'm desiring, or something like that. Like there's not that much difference to me. I do a lot of tarot, astrology, like, for me, there's no one thing that I'm drawn to. It's like, and I think that's the beauty for me that I found in my spiritual practice is like, you can't do it wrong. Like, it's just supposed to be a way to connect. So just find a way to connect, right? And and sometimes that's one-on-one with friends, or just by myself, or in a group. But and then, you know, sometimes we're doing really big, thoughtful rituals, like for Halloween, we'll do like some kind of ritual where we're honoring our loved ones who've passed, and it's feels very sacred and special. And sometimes it's something silly, you know. So
nature is a big part of your story. We were talking a bit about nature walks on old Cape Cod.
Yeah.
What has your connection to nature looked like throughout your life? Like, how has it evolved? Was there anyone in your life that encouraged you to explore the natural world?
I think being an only child, I just spent a lot of time outside. Like, I was often playing by myself or playing with the dog. And so I'd like take the dog for a walk. We lived for a long time, up until I was 12, we lived by a cranberry bog. So I would go and like walk the dog on the cranberry bog. And like my parents weren't particularly outdoorsy. My dad owned restaurants on the Cape. So really summertime was like he was working 80 hours a week all summer long, and we didn't really see him. But my mom loved going to the beach. So we'd go to the beach all the time. But I think I just developed my own relationship with nature and felt comfort in nature. And, you know, to this day, like any kind of body of water or woods or piece of land, like, and me and a dog going for a walk is like such a nice, wonderful thing to do.
Yeah. Dog is key.
Yes.
What is the connection to Barbados?
Yeah. So my dad's family is from Barbados. My dad grew up in New York City, but his dad was from Barbados, and his maternal grandparents were from Barbados. So that whole half of my family is from there. And my grandfather was the oldest of 11. So I have a lot of cousins and great aunts and uncles that are still living on the island. And I try and go back as often as possible to be with family.
Awesome. Cool. You consider yourself a storyteller. So what makes a good story?
I think, at least for the work I'm doing, I'm trying to be as honest as possible. So it's the truth that makes a good story. And the truth, especially when it comes to our emotions and how we actually really feel. I think my best songs are when I write the things I'm really afraid to tell people. That for me, obviously there's fiction and there's great works of fiction, but for me, so much of songwriting is about how can I be as honest as possible and how can I be in the actual feeling. I think we spend so much of our lives trying to avoid our feelings, and our job as artists is to be really vulnerable and try and inspire other people to be really vulnerable.
Yeah. So something I've noticed about you is that you are like both left-brained and right-brained. Like, you're very good at communicating. You're a good community organizer. You are good at applying for grants. You're good at advocating, very left-brain. And then also, you're also creative, free-spirited person, like an artist, very right-brained. And that's like not always something that goes hand in hand, and that one person can do both so well. How do you see those sides of you like living parallel in your life? Do they get along?
That is a really great observation, because that's 100% true. I'm like 50-50 right brain, left brain. And I call myself like a type A creative. You know, I think in the world that we're living in currently, where independent artists have to do so much administrative work, it's really, 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 really helpful. I think sometimes what gets in the way is I'm like a super high achiever, and I'm always kind of like, let's just keep going, on to the next thing, on to the next thing, on to the next thing. And I think actually creativity often happens sometimes like in the in-between, where there's like some space.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's been like important. But what I do now is I just like schedule space.
How'd you learn that trick?
Just by kind of realizing like, oh, there's not enough space for me to do certain things. Like if it's on my calendar, I'll do it. Like that's just kind of like, and this is like a small example, but when I teach songwriting, one of the things I teach is freedom and structure. So I usually start with freedom, which is we do some sort of free write. I give my students some sort of prompt and I just say, just write, like no editor, no filter, just write. And then once that part is over and you kind of just like dump everything out, then we create form and structure. And we figure out the form of the song, everything from like key, time signature to, you know, line structure, rhyme, all of those things. But if you start with form, you end up like being the editor before there's even been a writer, if that makes sense. And so I think that's how those two sides of my brain work, is like let there be freedom and creativity. But, you know, I can be really weird and out there. And so if there isn't any kind of structure, you know, unless I was wanting to make like super avant-garde music, like things wouldn't make any sense.
Right, right.
So trying to do both, but making sure, for me, I think I have to make sure that the editor stays put first and lets the creative be creative.
So this was a few years ago, but you were on the podcast Wild Womb talking about your endometriosis and your adenomyosis.
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 Yes.
So something that sounds like it was a huge roadblock in getting care was how much women's pain is normalized and the fact that you couldn't get the right people to listen to you. So what has your health journey taught you about how to advocate either for yourself or for others?
Ooh, Cindy, this is like, I could write a whole novel on that question. Thank you for asking. I think that what I've learned is that doctors are experts in medicine, but I'm an expert on my own body. And you're an expert on your own body because I am the only person that's actually experiencing my body. And so I have had to go through a lot of doctors to find ones that get that and are not trying to convince me that what I'm feeling is not happening. But instead, my current PCP, I literally said to them, I was like, I need you to be like a co-investigator. Like, we're solving a mystery. And if you're not down to do that with me, then I don't want to work with you. So I was really quite blunt with them. And they were like, I am down to be a co-investigator and solve the mystery of your body with you. Cool. But yeah, I've just had so many people try to dismiss my pain or, you know, doctors kind of go like, oh, well, like, and so often I just had to say like, okay, I'm in charge of my body and I'm the one who feels it. So it's just like self-trust, to be honest. I think what's also been helpful is understanding that the medical system is fucked and that's just what it is. And like knowing that and understanding that it's not an easy system to navigate and that realistically you probably have to see, especially with endometriosis, you're going to have to see a lot of different doctors, and being able to mm-hmm. accept that that's part of the journey and that it's not just me that's experiencing it, but so many other people are experiencing it. I don't like that fact, but it has given me an understanding of like, this is part of the work of like working yeah. towards health, is that I'm going to have to do a lot of my own research, a lot of my own advocating for myself.
Right. You basically have like a medical degree.
Yes. And it's wild that you say that, but I've met doctors where I'm like, I know more about my illness than you do. And, you know, that's can be a little yeah. frightening when you're in the room with someone and you're like, ooh, I think you actually don't know things that I know.
Right. Time to go.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. Gotta go. So you said on the podcast that you used to have pain every day and that seemed like really normal to you, that you were taught that pain comes with like being a woman. How has your relationship to pain changed since then?
I feel, and this is like from a spiritual perspective as well as just like a practical one, but I think that pain is the language of the body. And pain is how our bodies communicate to us. And for me, it's then my job to try and respond to my body's pain in the best way that I can. So mm-hmm. I'm still in pain quite often. I'm not like I'm still in pain a lot. And so when I am feeling pain, I just kind of try and pause and I say, like, what is my body trying to communicate to me through this pain? Like, is it that, like, I need to go take a nap? Like, is it that, like, I ate something that is inflaming my body? Is it that, you know, I need to take a muscle relaxer? Like, what is my body trying to communicate to me? And try and think of the pain more as neutral instead of as a negative thing that's happening to me.
Yeah.
And that when you're having enduring pain, chronic pain, it's usually because there is a chronic issue. You know, I had like, I don't know, like 5 or 6 different organs that have been affected by my endometriosis. So of course I'm going to be in pain. Often my organs are not doing well, right? So,
mm-hmm.
And I've always been really nervous when any doctor tries to like give me something that's just managing symptoms, because the symptoms are often telling me that something's wrong, and I want to be able to at least initially hear when the symptom is like going off, because that's letting me know that something's off in my body.
Hearing you talk about your experience with endo, you seem like you're just like, I was like, Whoa, you are so willing to talk about anything that was going on with that particular experience. But like, you just seem like such like a truly open book. Where does that openness come from, and what rewards have you experienced because of that openness?
I think in general, I'm a fairly confident person, and I don't feel like shame or embarrassment very often. And so, like, I'm not embarrassed to talk about my illness, and I don't have shame around my illness because therefore, like, I think, and I know when I talk about my illness, it helps other people. I have like personally diagnosed like 4 or 5 people with endometriosis just through like sharing my story and hearing, listening to their story. But I think that's also like, I feel the same way, like when I'm on stage singing a very vulnerable song, like the vulnerability is hard, but I don't have like shame for the feeling. I'm not embarrassed that I'm like a human being in a body with feelings. So it allows me to just kind of like show up and be honest about who I am in this moment. And I don't know, it doesn't like occur to me to really do it any other way. Like trying to pretend that I'm well when I'm actually ill, or trying to pretend that I'm like happy when I'm actually sad, is that would be more work.
So what you're saying is you woke up like this?
I guess so. Yeah. I think so.
Wow. You are very involved at Club Passim in Cambridge. This is like a very basic question, but how did you get involved there, and what does it mean to have that community?
You know, I moved to Boston in 2014, and I started going to open mics there, fresh out of college, just going to open mics. And then from there, like, had other friends in the folk scene, and they kind of like invited me up on stage at shows, and I booked a campfire, and you know, it kind of just expanded outward and outward from there. And now I'm a part of their folk collective, and I feel, and I really try not to take it for granted, I feel incredibly lucky to have such an amazing folk institution in my backyard. I know that so many artists don't have something like that. And whether I'm performing there or going to a show, I know it's just an incredible resource. So, and I've made really amazing community. I think especially as a, you know, some of my artwork can end up being quite insular, poetry and songwriting. And it's been really amazing to just be able to connect with other artists and feel like I'm part of a collective, which I think all artists need.
So your latest album is Cycle and Change. And on this record, lots of things are going on this record. Oh my God, we need another hour. You made an effort to fully embrace your identity as a songwriter and a witch. I'd like to start there. What has that effort looked like for you, and how did it feel to merge those identities?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about like my spirituality and nature and all of these things. And I think my previous projects up until Cycle and Change, I was trying to kind of separate those things. I was like, you know, spirituality has to kind of be over here, and art making is over here. And Cycle and Change was my like aha moment of like, no, actually they're the same thing and they need to come together. And why can't I make a record that's spiritual? And why can't the process of making the record be spiritual?
So this is a quote about the record. It says, each song ties back to its seasonal context, weaving a story that spans spring's hopeful beginnings, summer's vibrancy, autumn's introspection, and winter's quietude. So it hits on all four seasons. And we start in spring. Mm-hmm. Where did you come up with the concept to travel through the year seasonally? And how did you decide to start with spring? And I have another question, but I'll just ask two questions at once.
Well, part of it again was those my spiritual practice is seasonal. So I do all of the equinoxes and the summer and winter solstice. And then there are cross quarter holidays. So there's like 8 sun holidays that I celebrate every year. And I've been doing that since 2010 and grew up in that. And so kind of the just concept of that cycle is ingrained in me. And what happened was I wrote the title track, I think it was like April 2020 in lockdown, like totally isolated and sad. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize it, but I have kind of I'm starting to collect songs that are seasonal and kind of are living in a place. And so then I started actually writing with intention, like, can I write some summer songs? Can I write a couple more fall songs? So it just kind of unfolded. And, you know, when I look, the record took 4 years to like make, but it's a period of a decade of writing. And I didn't know that I was writing it. It just was what I was writing.
The album highlights nature as a teacher and a mirror. And you want us to embrace our emotions and connect with the cycles that ground us, reminding us that even amidst change, there is beauty and stability in the natural world. So you and I were supposed to talk about this album last year.
Mm-hmm. In April,
but a bunch of things happened for you right in the final stretch of getting ready to release this album. All these like very hard things. Your dad suddenly passed away. You went through a divorce. You relocated. You had a whole album about all of these things.
Yeah.
So how are you able to keep the lessons of cycle and change with you during difficult times?
It's so funny. My therapist, you know, in therapy, I'm not talking about music because that's not like the thing that I need therapy for. But at one point I kind of said to my therapist, like, well, this is what my album is about that's coming out. And she was like, oh, you wrote the medicine that you need actually right now. And so I've felt that like the lessons on the record are what I needed this year. And as much as the art is for other people, it's also art that is like still for me. I think it's also helped me to let go. Like I was going to tour the record and do, you know, a big hometown release show and all of these things, and I didn't do any of it. And I don't think I'm going to. Like, I think maybe this record is just not gonna get that. And I'm already like, it's looking like potentially in February or March, I'll be back in the studio working on the next record. So I think what I have just come to accept is like the, you know, way you're supposed to do things sometimes based off of the season of life you're in is just not how things work out, and that's okay.
Mm. Your dad, you've posted lots of pictures of your dad, and he just seems like such a huge presence. You also posted a song that you wrote recently that, in your words, captures the specific grief of my dad's last day. How has your father's death impacted your creativity?
I think for a big chunk of time, I was not really feeling very creative. And for a big chunk of time, I wasn't singing, because the last time I sang was my partner brought their guitar to the hospital, and my partner and a few friends were there, and we sang my dad. And so I literally couldn't sing for several months without bursting into tears, because I was like, just kept being brought back to that moment. And I'm just now starting to write about it. So I think I just needed a lot of time. Like, you know, it's like the wound was too fresh to be like, let me now write a song about this. And it's funny, I do this thing called writing 10 songs in one day. It's a workshop I do with Club Passim. We do it like the beginning of January. And I ended up writing a bunch of songs. And I've been trying to write songs about my dad. But what I'm noticing is that like what I actually need to write is about the process of him dying. like it's not so much like portraits of him as much as it is the very specific moments of, you know, what it feels like to call my uncle in Barbados on the phone and let him know that my dad's dying and just hear my uncle like break down into tears. Like, that's actually what I am writing about. It's not so much about like this person, but the experience of witnessing death and this like great transformation. And just like songwriting was for me when I was growing up, like I have more skills and tools now, but I'm still using it to process, basically.
Yeah.
And my hope is to be as vulnerable and as honest as possible in that processing and to not hide away from that.
Mm. Wow. Well, this has been really wonderful talking to you. And before I let you go, will you do a very quick lightning round?
Yes.
Yes, they say yes. Okay. Question number one, what is your ideal stage outfit?
Oh, sorry, this is not lightning at all.
It never is.
I so want to be able to just be like a rock star that goes out in jeans and a fun graphic tee. Like, as much as I want to dress up and look
like Bart Simpson.
Yeah, like I just want to be like casual cool. Like, anytime I put on like a kind of crazy outfit, I'm like, I really just want to be like in jeans and a tee right now. So I think that's my yeah.
Okay. What tarot card are you hoping for before you get on stage?
I think I would say it's the Fool, because the Fool is just taking a leap of faith and is down to make some mistakes and is having a really fun time. And that is the tarot card that I want to embody.
That's a really good answer. Are you a dog friend or a cat friend?
I am a dog. There are two dogs living in my house, and I respect cats, but I also think that cats are sadists and should probably be outside. So, yeah.
What are you ordering on the Club Passim food menu?
This is very controversial because they took away the black bean burger, but then they brought it back.
Okay.
So for a while, I didn't know what to order because I always order the black bean burger with the rosemary fries and a half salad. So that's what I'm ordering now. But for about a year, I was really lost.
Oh, boy. Sorry to hear. This is the final question. If you were a flower, what flower would you be?
Cindy, that's a very hard question. Oh, no.
What flower would you be today?
I'm going to just be a peony. They're so lush and
dramatic.
Dramatic and delicate and endlessly opening. And yeah, that's what I would want to be. Yeah.
Okay. All stellar answers except the cat.
Sorry.
I'm more of a cat friend. Well, thank you so much. This has really been wonderful to talk to you.
Thanks, Cindy. I'm glad we could do this.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. Go to FolkAlley.com or FolkAlley's mobile app, BasicFolk.com, or you can go listen wherever you get your little shows on your little phone device. That's where you can find us. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. I suggest sharing it with that friend in high school who is always telling you about witches, and that if she does something to somebody as a witch, it comes back three times to her. Send it to her. I think her name was Vanessa. Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. Talk to you next time. Bye.